Hello and welcome to another magic edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and over the next half hour, I bring you interviews with the unlikeliest of bedfellows. Once considered the world's most beautiful woman, Isabella Rossellini discusses her role in now continuing her neo-realist father's film legacy. Then we step into the ring with Stephen Riley, director of a new documentary about the Oxbridge Varsity boxing match. Then there's Mitchell and Webb, the Peep Show boys, venturing onto the big screen with a comedy about two rubbish magicians. Only the wonderful world of film can include all this, and only Film Weekly can bring them all to you in the same show. We'll let beauty sweep all before it and start with Isabella Rossellini, who was in London last week to open a season of her father's films at the NFT, celebrating what would have been his 100th birthday. Roberto Rossellini was one of the fathers of Italian neorealism, a brand of cinema that introduced naturalistic, documentary-style performances and real locations to the studio-bound world of cinema. Roberto was a larger-than-life figure and, co-writing with a young Federico Fellini, Rome Open City remains perhaps his best-known picture. Set in Nazi-occupied Rome and released just months after the end of the war, the film starred Italian beauty Anna Magnani. His film earned him the admiration of the cinema world, including that of popular Swedish actress Ingrid Bergman, who felt so moved by the film that she wrote to the director declaring her eagerness to work with him. Bergman's letter led to the pair's collaboration on another moving wartime drama, Stromboli, then to a high-profile extramarital affair and the birth of Isabella. Rossellini's films, including his swan song Messiah from 1977, can be seen in a two-part series of retrospectives at the NFT, and when I met up with Isabella, I asked her if curating a season of her father's films made her proud.
I am very, very proud that my dad's retrospective has been travelling to several countries, from Canada to United States, France, Spain, Portugal, Morocco, and now even here in England.
Was he a kind of a travelling man himself? Now, as you say, these films are kind of like a vagabond. I see there's a kind of gypsy spirit to both the films and the way that they're kind of seen, I think.
Well, sure, he did. My father did films mostly in Italy, but he did shoot some films abroad, and he did a wonderful documentary in India. I'm very touched mostly because my father's work has been more influential than commercial. And it's thanks to these great institutions and museums that his film is preserved and are continuing to be seen by probably other filmmakers who still today tell me that they're greatly influenced by him.
I think very much, and as a film critic, I'm not a maker, but as a critic, one is also very influenced, I think, by them. One's aesthetic is kind of forged by the work that your father did.
Well, though aesthetic was not something that he was interested in at all. He tried to keep things very simple, very stark. He was very interested in the content and decided and always said that it's the content that determines the style and also how much money do you have and what kind of production you can afford. So the conflict between cinema seeing as an aesthetic art or as a style and the content was actually at the core of the debate of my father versus studios and projections and systems, because my father was also a great created a lot of polemics. What do you call it?
Polemicist. It's not very easy to say, even in English. It's interesting that you say that, Isabella, because for me, it's the look of the films as much as the content that really strikes home. I think at the time, no one was doing films that had that realism to them, or the neo-realism to come to know. But now one expects to see that in so many indie works outside the studio system. In a way, he kind of created the first indie cinema.
Yeah, he did indeed create it. He's the father of the indie cinema. But he didn't sit down with Visconti and Vittorio De Sica, other neorealistic filmmakers, and discuss, well, let's try to do a new style and let's call it neorealism. It was a cry from civilians who had lived a war. This film came out after Second World War. And it was the attempt to use this media, this cinema, to show the reality, a suffering reality, the voice of the people that had not been heard, that had not spoken, the civilians, what was the voice of the civilian during the war, not the military, the propaganda film. And so the film were made very starkly, very simply, because they had very little money. But the urge to make the film was to speak up, not to create a new aesthetic. The aesthetic was dictated by how few means they had.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, again, that you say that your father decided to give a voice to this people.
He didn't give the voice. He was part of them.
He felt very much part of the people that he chronicled.
Yes, I mean, he talked about post-war Italy, and he was in Italy during the war, so he talked on behalf of the Italian civilians, the Italians that were the enemy. Italy was a fascist country, and was defeated in the war. And I think my father's film, in Neorealism, gave the Italians their, again, it was a redeeming quality in their film, because finally the people could see beyond the political fascist Nazis and could see again the humanity in the enemy.
I think all of their films, I think Rome, Open City, particularly, they invite personal readings. I think you look at the screen and one sees one's own meanings in it, and one has relationships to different characters in there. I particularly must confess a particular kind of personal longing, because my honeymoon, which is about a month away, begins in Stromboli.
Oh, really? Yes. Oh, great. How fun is that?
Which I presume in some way has a deep personal meaning for you, because I believe that's where your mother and father met.
Yes, they did. Did meet in Stromboli. It's a beautiful place. At the time, it was a God-forgotten island, you know, of earthquakes and fish going around occasionally. So the fishermen trying to catch them, but really poor, with an enormous. Most of the islands were abandoned, with people migrating to Australia or United States.
These are the Aeolian Islands.
Yes, the Aeolian Islands, north of Sicily, and now they've become incredible resorts. They are very wealthy. Actually, it's one of the greatest things that I've witnessed in my life. It was to see Italy and part of Italy that were so poor becoming rich. You know, really, it's possible. Mm-hmm. It can happen. I've seen it.
And do you go back to Stromboli? I mean, in a way, that's almost where you owe your life to, yeah. Stromboli and the magic of it.
I went once or twice to see the islands, but no, I live in the United States, so going there is quite far. And then whenever I get there, I'm so celebrated, because the island still has every restaurant a photo of the film. So everybody, you know, ends up throwing too many parties for me. So I do go, but not as much.
It's just too much celebrate if you do. It's exhausting. Do you, when you now see your father's films collected as they are here at the NFT in a retrospective, what are your own personal feelings to them? Not only the fact that your mother and father met during the filming of them, but you must have been around while he was creating them, thinking of them, had been on set. Tell me a few of your experiences about the making of them.
Well, I think that, yeah, I was there not that much. You know, I was a little girl. I had to go to school, so I wasn't that much on the set, but I was sometimes on the set. But I think that what I'm very proud of is that when my parents died, they died within 4 years from each other, about 30 years ago, there was absolutely no awareness of film conservation, restoration and conservation. And so it was a very big struggle, and it was a very big work on the part of a lot of us to create the infrastructures, mm-hmm. for museums, for art cinema, to see this. And so it's a great satisfaction for me to see that 30 years we were able to put together, all together, this retrospective.
Isabella Rossellini there. The first half of the exhaustive Rossellini season runs at the NFT at BFI Southbank until May the 31st. One of the most pleasant surprises of the year so far is the documentary Blue Blood by first-time director Stephen Riley. It's a fascinating, charming and very funny look at the Oxford University boxing team as the young lads prepare to take on Cambridge in the annual Blues match. We meet various characters, from gangly but game PPE student Cav to Justin, the smugly confident American, Ben, the public school golden boy, and Dez, the wonky-nosed coach who works on a building site. I donned my robes, tied up my gloves, and put my mouthguard in to meet director Stephen Riley.
Right, I come from a family of boxers. Yeah, my dad was a boxer, my older brother was a boxer, my younger brother, he was a boxer. My way of getting out of the old rat race was through going to the boxing club. It was a way of breaking out and achieving something. Now, I used to get in that ring and I was a king. It was my domain. It fascinates me. It absolutely fascinates me. University boys, these boys are going to, you know, they're at college. They're educated. I've never been into a boxing club before. I've never seen a pair of boxing gloves.
Blue Blood is a new and exciting documentary about the Oxford and Cambridge boxing match. New and exciting, I hear you say. Yes, dear listener, it is indeed. We have the director with us, Stephen Riley. Congratulations, Stephen, on making what I think is a wonderful, incisive and witty little film about what I think most people would think is a very arcane subject. How on earth did you pick this and think that it would have the legs to go the distance, if you like, as a documentary?
Well, I'd had my first experience of the boxing match between Oxford and Cambridge when I'd attended one when I was a student there once upon a time.
I've been to one too.
You've been to one? Yeah, you'll testify then. I mean, what was your first reaction?
I thought it was like a cockfight. It was amazing. It reminded me of a sort of underage, kind of bare-knuckle amateur spirit. But obviously, it was all kind of ABA regulated, and it was all kind of. But it was a baying kind of pit. It was almost medieval.
Absolutely. This is it. I mean, I've known about the club as well. I'd been training at the club, but even that kind of prior experience didn't sort of ready me for, you know, attending the match and feeling the atmosphere of the crowd. And I kind of that stuck with me for long after. And when I got into documentary, I sort of harked back and I thought, you know, actually that's something that needs to be covered.
You took the route of picking the sort of fresh recruits, if you like, and following them. Was there always a structure to your documentary that you were always going to kind of pick a bunch? Because in a way, you have to be lucky that you get an interesting bunch of lads.
Well, you know, actually, the one thing that the club normally guarantees, and that was, you know, even, you know, my experience there and the friends that I'd made in the club, is that you always get like a very mixed group. It's strange, you know, within the sort of diverse cross-section you get in the university anyway, the boxing club seems to, you know, just attract a real sort of like motley bunch of adventurers and sort of, you know, very sort of charismatic young guys.
I mean, most of them have never stepped in a ring before, never put on gloves before. What do you think makes them want to say, you know what, I'm going to step in front of whatever it is, 1,000 people, and get the life beaten out of me?
From, you know, observing the whole process, I mean, you know, the obvious goal is to get this award of a blue, and, you know, that is just an accolade that you can sort of, like, you know, you can bandy around that you fought against Cambridge, and that's, you know, that brings its own respect from people who fought themselves. But
the other place, it would be referred to as the other place on this show.
The other, I didn't want to be so pompous, but can we do that from now on?
Yes.
I mean, I think people, you know, the ones who participate as well, I think they're trying to overcome a lot more within themselves, you know, in the pursuit of boxing. You know, often, you know, there's a lot of apologists, I think, you know, when you go to a lot of people who go to Oxford and Cambridge, the other place, there's a certain amount of sort of denial, you know, when you meet other people, you know, when you meet kind of, you know, people in the street, to kind of, you know, to say that, you know, you weren't maybe affiliated. And so for these guys, perhaps, you know, it's their attempt to walk on the wild side in, you know, in some respect, and to show they're not these kind of, like, you know, manicured effete academics, and that they can actually sort of rough it if need be.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, there's also a lovely montage that you make of all these kind of old pictures of these gentlemen boxers kind of wearing their boaters and their top hats, and huzzah, when Oxford and Cambridge really were the only kind of two universities around, that kind of spirit and rivalry, you tap into that history, really, which boxing has, this kind of gentleman spirit to me. But it does strike me when I looked at those photos and that footage, everyone looks so old back then.
I guess I wonder if that was in the genome. I don't know whether we've sort of flushed that out, but no, yeah, the history of the sport, you know, is actually focused on Oxford and Cambridge, which not, you know, I think few people are aware of. The Oxford and Cambridge boxing match is the oldest inter-club rivalry in the world, and the Oxford club is the oldest club, amateur club, in the world as well. But you sense the immediate contradiction of academics and sort of bloodletting.
Bring it in, boys, come on. Start thinking about it now. It's a big night. It's a big night. You're going to be nervous, okay? Start visualizing it now so you don't freak out when you get there, okay? Start visualizing it, you know? See those lights. See the crowd. And block it out. They don't matter. It's just you in there. This is going to be the most selfish 6 minutes of your life.
I think your film is extremely well put together, especially in terms of music. You kind of fit some great tunes. You've got Moby, the Rolling Stones, a bit of Radiohead, a bit of opera, which I think is very wittily woven in. I did think, as soon as it finished, I thought, oh God, how did you get the clearance for that? It's a debut documentary and you've got some really big names in there.
Well, I probably went a bit sort of nuts in terms of, you know, the music I wanted to put in, you know, and I had a sort of wish list of tracks when I was editing the film. You know, you fall in love with you know, your kind of your own efforts and how the thing works, and then you realise, oh my God, now we've got to try and get the music rights, master recording rights. as well as the publishing rights, and that's a real minefield. And yeah, it took a long time. I mean, if only just to get it into the face of the artists, and for them to appreciate the budget, and for them to, you know, kind of have any faith in it. But, you know, luckily, yeah, I mean, you know, luckily people kind of were on board and sort of, you know, believed in the project, and that was fantastic.
You got a bit of Radiohead, who are an Oxford band.
Yeah, actually, Radiohead were the first band to watch the cut, and especially their section with Karma Police in, and they got back in touch and said that, you know, they were really into it, and that, yeah, they'd support the film, and that was fantastic, and that obviously that opened doors in terms of, like, you know, getting in touch with other bands. So,
yeah, no, congratulations. And in fact, the original music as well, there's like kind of nice flamenco scores and these kind of very elegant kind of bits of music to go with the kind of quite clumsy fighting that we're watching, but all very nicely choreographed together. So I thought that was a very strong suit of the film. Just tell me a bit about the actual work involved, how long you were following these lads for, and how you kind of earned their trust.
I got permission from the university, which was a tough job initially, but then, you know, went into the club, and I just kind of, you know, sort of ponced about with the camera for a while, you know, mingling with about sort of 100 or so sort of students, wannabes, who kind of like first enter the gym. And then, you know, I think, you know, people just get acclimatised to you sort of kicking around, and it was just me, you know, so it wasn't so sort of threatening as a full entourage, maybe with lighting and sound crew. I'd sort of balance the mic under the camera and sort of, you know, oaf around with my headphones on, and I think people just got kind of inured to me, you know.
So they let their guard down, is so to speak.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. And it relies a lot on trust, you know. I think so. If you spend a lot of time with them like that, as I was, it was about an 8-month filming period, you know, when they're and you know, from start to finish.
So you were up there every day. You followed them to training. I mean, how much did you shoot, and how much did you have to sculpt out of your edit?
Actually, there was quite a lot. I mean, we didn't go to. I'd go to sort of a few training sessions a week, and they're training a lot. I'd arrange times for, you know, for us to meet, you know, kind of separately. And but no, I had a lot of footage, about sort of 250 hours, which is, you know, it's a lot to get through. And I made the mistake as well. I mean, I'd skim through tapes at the end of the day, but I wish I'd kind of logged stuff as I went along, because it was a torturous kind of like 2-month period. Yeah. When I
was
just like...
It was your debut documentary. Next time you'll shoot just 2.5 hours and you'll be doing a quick edit. You'll be fine.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, I'll just gonna churn it out just for the masses.
I really enjoyed it. I also enjoyed the kind of mix of the sort of town and gown, particularly the trainer, Des, who was a sort of a local sort of builder who trains these guys. He was remarkably sort of fond of them. You know, I thought there might be some enmity, you know, like, oh, I'll get these toffs, I'll knock them into shape. There was none of that at all.
No, there's a great juxtaposition as well. I mean, what I really wanted to get across as well was part of my own university experience at Oxford. You know, I think, I mean, I approached the place with a lot of my own preconceptions, and I didn't let myself fully integrate, I think, in the first kind of like term when I was there. You know, I had this idea of the place being sort of a bit stuffy in many respects. My friends had gone to other unis, and I sort of regretted it in a way. But of course, you find your group, and you realise that it's nothing like that. And the boxing club actually taught me a fair bit in that regard. And so I wanted to do a piece that would reflect the real variety of experience you can get from the place. And Des, who's the coach, he juxtaposes very well. I mean, this guy, I mean, he's from like kind of a, you know, kind of one of the toughest states near to Oxford, Blackbird Lees, and he's from a completely different background, sort of veteran of 170 fights. And yeah, he I think he combines well with the guys, and sort of hopefully it will reverse a few people's ideas, you know, through his interaction with the guys of how to do, you know, how to kind of like treat the idea of Oxbridge, you know.
There's also, he's got a local butcher sort of bloke who helps him, and there's a bit where they're carrying these carcasses of pigs or cows, whatever they are. I was half expecting a sort of Rocky-like little montage in the deep freeze there, Steve.
Do you know, actually, I did try to coax Jim, who's the assistant coach, into that, but he got a bit bashful at that point, and so I sort of let him off the hook.
Nobody really does that, do they?
No, well, he nearly did. I think we nearly had some. I'd asked him, but no, No, he thought, no, I've got to sell this stuff. What would you be punching it for?
Stephen Riley, congratulations on Blue Bloods. Thanks for coming on Observer Film Weekly. Love to see you. Best of luck with this film, and congratulations.
Thank you.
James, we want this. We're going to be strong. We're going to be brave. He's going to come charging at you. Be ready.
The British TV comedy spin-off movie has a rotten reputation. The 70s were full of them, from Are You Being Served to George and Mildred and Cannon and Ball in The Boys in Blue. The genre died until Bean revived it in 1996, which then tempted Guest House Paradiso out of TV's bottom, literally, and sent Kevin and Perry to Ibiza. Recently, Shaun of the Dead surprised many by actually being a successful big-screen transfer, and the League of Gentlemen carried it off too. But how will David Mitchell and Robert Webb, stars of Peep Show, fare under the larger scrutiny of the cinema audience? Their debut film is called Magicians, and written by the Peep Show team of Jesse Armstrong and Sam Bain, it pits Mitchell and Webb as an acrimonious pair of magicians reforming to enter a competition among a host of ridiculous northern nightclub acts. Magicians is hardly groundbreaking, but it does have a gentle charm, and it's directed by Andrew O'Connor, who used to present game shows on TV, such as Chain Letters and The Alphabet Game. I went to meet with all of them. Welcome to Film Weekly, David, Robert, Andrew.
Hello.
The creators of The Magicians. In fact, one is a magician and turned director, that's Andrew. And Mitchell and Webb, we know from television and computer adverts. This is a departure for you two.
You've noticed those.
Where are they playing?
I don't know, just a couple of... I think there's the odd small picture if you lift a flap on a menu somewhere. But
it's certainly not the cinema.
In the odd restaurant. They're not in the cinema. No. What, when Magicians comes out on the 18th of May? Would you be able to see them there?
Were you child magicians, the two of you?
Nope. You had a Paul Daniels magic set, didn't you, David?
Yes, I did.
And what did you learn from that, David?
Various tricks that I can no longer do. And I don't think I ever particularly... I don't think I ever got good at them, because I sort of would work out how it was done, and then I had no particular love of the performing of it. So yeah, I suspect when I did those tricks for my parents, it was painfully obvious to them how the tricks were done as well.
My experience of magicians is that if you can sing, dance, act or tell a joke, you haven't got to perform a trick to get attention.
Right.
So, and if you can't learn a trick, then you become a hypnotist. That's basically my experience.
It's the hierarchy, yes. Yeah.
Or the lowrarchy.
The lowrarchy, yeah. Yes. We were comedy nerds rather than magician nerds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the two aren't that far apart. Because I mean, my brother was a magician, the great Danielli. I don't know if you've come across him, Andrew.
No, not yet. Obviously, I'm happy to audition him at any point.
The sponge balls trick.
Yes, sponge balls.
The old folks of Nightingale House, Clapham, were very impressed.
They loved that. Yeah, no, that's
brilliant.
But have you learned some tricks now?
I learnt how to make billiard balls appear.
Which isn't that useful in everyday life?
No, it's surprising.
Apart from anything else, you have to carry the prop around with you, which
a true magician would do.
Yeah. What, a 12x6 slate bed billiard table?
No, balls. No. It's just a sort of little, slightly inexpertly manufactured tube. You can sort of tell that these were made for a run of, say, maybe a few hundred sales maximum, rather than several million.
Yeah, and I was Andrew and the consultant magician Scott Penrose, very nice men. They tried to teach me how to roll a 50p across my fingers in a smooth and debonair way. And after 2 weeks, I said that wasn't really coming on very well.
Well, you couldn't do it sober.
I couldn't do it sober. Whereas, crucially, I can't act drunk. So. Andrew kindly told me to quit. Just give up.
I'm a bit worried about becoming a dad or an uncle and not being able to do tricks at parties, because there's always someone who can't... I can't even do the kind of behind-your-ear simple
I can do
stuff.
The behind-the-ear thing in a way that would bamboozle a slow four-year-old.
But moving on to more serious... But not obviously, magic is a serious business,
yes.
Andrew. I would never say it isn't. But you're actually sort of making slight fun of that, of the whole... magic scene, and Andrew, I suppose I'll ask you, because the magic circle are quite tight about who they let in and their rules. How are they sort of seeing this picture? I mean, you're taking the mickey out of them slightly.
Well, I was thrown out of the magic circle. I was thrown out of the inner magic circle, in fact, not for this movie, for exposing tricks on a television show earlier. But the main magic consultant on the show was a guy called Scott Penrose, and he's on the council of the magic circle.
So that's like inside the inner.
That's inside the inner. That's
some kind of uber wizard. What do they call that?
Magic sphincter.
He's the literal... Scott is at the epicentre of the magic sphincter. And he was there at all times to make sure that we didn't do anything that was naughty.
Yes.
But the general tone, I think they'll be more upset by the swearing and the general shocking level of comedy tone of the film, the more than the trick exposure.
I think what you learn is that there isn't really magic, like real magic.
is there.
But hopefully we hope our audience
What's
know
he saying?
That.
Is,
we,
he saying, is he saying that none of it's real?
Or we there hope, is a Santa Claus.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go that
granted.
Far. Yeah, obviously.
But outside of that, you can't bend the laws of nature.
No. That was the tagline, wasn't it? You can't bend the laws of nature.
Yeah, this time it's not personal.
Right.
Yeah. That reminds me of Alan Alda's line in Hannah and Her Sisters about if it bends, it's funny.
It's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny.
You see?
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
So Andrew obviously knows his Woody Allen as well as his... there must be
Paul Daniels.
Paul Daniels, yeah. Exactly, the two. You two kept making what is... one of the great kind of TV to big screen transfers. Quite, I mean, when it happened for, say, the space people, Simon and Edgar, the Shaun of the Dead phenomenon, then it happened to you, I was a bit concerned that it was perhaps a step too far for the two of you. But I've seen the film, and actually you manage it. You pull
well,
it off.
Thank goodness. I was worried for a second.
Yeah, I was concerned. When I saw it, I knew I was right to be concerned.
Actually,
you fucked it up.
What the hell are you doing?
Yeah. But was there an element of what the hell are we doing? There's always an element of what the hell are we doing on your face, David.
Yeah, thank you. Well, no, to be honest, not really, because, it was a very funny script written by Sam and Jesse, who write Peep Show, and, they wanted us to play the main parts in it.
And that's what drew us to the project.
Yeah, and you sort of think, what, you never know, things don't always come off, but if not now, when to try that, if not when you're reading a script you like and you're being offered the main part.
Yes.
And also, what would I be holding out
and
for?
And a romantic lead.
Yeah, absolutely.
Indeed. Yeah.
So I'd have to have my teeth done to play that in Hollywood.
Screw that.
Yeah.
Are you film... most people are film fans, but are you... I mean, Spaced had an obvious kind of referencing in its comedy to sort of film things, whereas Peep Show doesn't quite have that. But are you two kind of film nerds, or particularly in comedy?
I don't think we're film nerds, actually. I think
no, not really.
We're film fans. I think Andrew's probably more of a film nerd than
I think Andrew's probably seen more films. I've had a bit of a head start.
I've never particularly wanted to do, to do comedy with lots of film references in it because I don't get half of them. Yeah. And I suppose I'm not into film to that extent.
I think when we wanted to do...
I'm into comedy a lot, and some comedy films are brilliant, but a lot of brilliant comedy is television comedy.
Yeah. Now, just most people will be aware of you, Robert and David, from Peep Show. From Peep Show.
Yes.
And The Magician. But, Andrew, a lot of people won't realise that your connection with them has gone all the way. You did do the Peep Shows, as you said there.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you always had this kind of yearning to kind of put your magic background to sort of more obvious use.
Well, the sort of key show that we make is Derren Brown. My company makes Derren Brown stuff. So, obviously, I've got a massive love for magic and a massive love for British comedy.
Because you were a magician, that's right.
I was. When I was 18, I won a magic competition called the Young Magician of the Year. It's been going on since like the 60s or something. I didn't win it in the 60s, I just stressed.
No, I know.
Thank you. One of the trophies they hold in the is my Young Magician of the Year competition trophy. So I sort of knew that world very well. I just sort of felt that you'd never seen... The Strictly Ballroom showed you that weird world of ballroom dancing. It just felt that you'd never seen the world of the weird, slightly mental amateur magician and convention. So it just felt like a really ripe area to go and look at.
And it is. I mean, it is ripe for comic. I mean, you just think each time there's a new act coming on, they're going to be funny.
Yeah.
And they are. Were the people you got, are they actors, or are they some of them real from that the whatever working men's club circuit?
Well, now, when you see the guys queuing up to go in an audition for the competition, they're all real magicians with their own costumes. No costumes were supplied for those people, including Ali Bongo. And when you go on the magic convention, people are sort of selling tricks at a table. They're all real magic dealers, genuinely demoing the tricks they sell.
What about the remarkable Carringtons? Were
they aren't real.
They are real. They're my favourite. Yeah. Sam and Jesse just wrote in. The remarkable Carringtons, it's just this old couple, and we have no idea what they do. Yeah. We never see them do their act, but they're just this two beaming old people.
And they only claim to be remarkable. Not the amazing or the marvellous or the unbelievable character. The remarkable character. That was remarkable. I may at some point remark on that.
Well, the quite interesting Mitchell and Webb. Thank you very much for coming on the film, really. Andrew O'Connor, nice to see you.
It's remarkable. It's a remarkable thing.
Remarkable O'Connor.
We made a movie. It's fantastic.
No, brilliant. And congratulations on it. I hope it does well and gets people in there, because you are up against, as you say,
Spider-Man 3. But I think you've got him lit. Your Absolutely. Costumes are much better.
Yeah, he can't produce Thank you. Balls.
Can he?
No.
Amazingly, that's all we've got time for another episode of Film Weekly. I'm packing my flip-flops and my suntan lotion because I'm off to the Côte d'Azur and the 60th Cannes Film Festival. I'll be giving you the rundown of the hottest films that unspool on the Croisette, as well as all the gossip, all the parties, and all the hottest deals. I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly was produced, as ever, by Paul Noble. And until next time, au revoir, mes amis.